This means... for whatever you want it for.
Okay.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel
Myers.
You
said it was
Myers.
For whatever I wanted
whatever
it
you
for.
Want. You're the guest. You're the guest. My guest this week is Beth Lapidus. Comedian, writer, host of her own podcast, Life and Beth. You still have that, right?
I still have it.
All right. You may have seen her, Sex and the City, Will and Grace, the documentary film I Am Comic, or a million other places, right?
On all Cabaret on Amazon, yeah, on Cabaret and Comedy Central.
Yes, that's all. It's all there.
All that.
Yeah, perhaps most of all since 1988.
Is that true? Right? Oh, my gosh.
It said somewhere that you've
somewhere.
Been doing Uncabaret
yeah, a long time. Yeah.
Since 1988.
Yeah, since I was two.
Weekly live comedy and variety show here in L.A. But first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. My guest today is Beth Lapidus. Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Here's a goofy question.
Alrighty.
I just had this thought. When the Hebrews name a girl Beth or a boy Beth, it's not short for Elizabeth
not
or
not at
other
all.
Thing.
No,
Beth,
no.
Right?
Beth.
How did Elizabeth come? Because Beth is a very old, thousands of years old.
It means house.
Yeah.
House, like when you see Beth, you know, and on a temple.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. I don't know.
Elizabeth.
I don't know. Elizabeth, maybe they thought not enough. Maybe not enough. Beth seems too short. Let's pump it up. Let's give her more.
They needed something to say.
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
It probably comes from a whole different, it's probably a completely different etymology.
Oh, you think? Oh,
I think so.
Now I'm curious about that. All right. I want to just ask a goofy question.
So that's the second goofy question.
What, the first one was goofy?
You said, according to you.
Second one.
Okay.
Well, here's something that I ran into. I was downtown L.A. recently, and I walked into some old bookstore.
Mm.
And the people there, they had this an old joke book, like a guy wrote it for himself in 19-something. And this is one of the jokes that was in there. Would you read this and see if you could explain it to me? You have to read it out loud.
Seems Worried.
Yeah, that's the title
that's
of the joke.
That's the title of the joke. Yeah, I like the title. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Seems Worried.
Yeah.
Three storks met at the street corner to relate their experiences of the night before.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good night, remarked one. I delivered two sets of twins and a single. Five singles was my record, commented the second. As the third stork looked rather glum, the other two turned to him. What luck did you have, they asked. Not much, he replied gloomily. All I did was scare the hell out of a couple of stenographers.
Do you get this joke?
I do not. I think it's very zen. I think it's, I don't know what it has to do with being worried, but I think that it must have to do with the unexpected thing that all stork, you know, that all storks, stork is a funny word, by the way.
Because it has a K in it, yes.
Stork, it just sounds funny, and... would be delivering babies, but the third one is just busy doing something else and scaring people. Maybe the stenographers thought, oh my God, here's the maybe it's this. You see, this has to do with comedy not translating over time,
yes.
Because maybe stenographer is the code word for single girl from 19-whatever, whenever this was written.
40s or 50s.
This is what a single girl does. She's a stenographer. So
and she
if,
might be sleeping with her boss.
Well, whoever she's sleeping with, if the stork shows up, that means like, oh my God, I'm pregnant.
Yes.
So I think it's a single girl joke.
So...
the putting two and two together. That took a lot of brain power. I'm done for the day.
That's it, right? I mean, that's kind of what I thought it could be.
But, you know, this is something we call two-step joke. You have to think about it now because the thought takes the funniness away. But it's something people do. It's something smart comedians have to learn as they're coming up because, you know, you're skipping ahead. You're fast. Your brain is fast.
Right.
And it's brilliant and it's so fun to watch, but you haven't given the audience a chance to catch up.
So this is that kind of...
Now it would be a two-step joke. Previously, it would just be a bad joke, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a story joke. I mean, it's so old-fashioned, but yeah, whatever.
It is old-fashioned.
Yeah. But I like the title, Seems Worried. I think that's
a provocative.
That's my favorite thing of the whole joke is the title, Seems Worried, but
now,
is actually happy.
Now that you... So who is it that
who
seems
is it
worried?
That seems worried? I think the stenographers.
I think that's the...
And also, why were there two? Why did he scare the?
Yeah,
why did the stork scare a couple of stenographers?
Yeah, why were they there?
Why didn't he just scare a stenographer?
Well, I think a couple of stenographers is just funny. Again, it has
a couple of stenographers
things.
Has a ring.
Yeah, but now that you're saying seems worried, that tells me, yeah, the worried parts are the stenographers, and I think you're right. They saw the stork. They thought they were pregnant.
Yes.
They weren't.
Did I pass?
Stenographers.
Did I get an A+ in old jokeography?
You got an A+.
Has any guest ever been so entranced by your bell?
We're working on it. We're working
all
on it.
Right.
We're growing up. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, this book was like some guy wrote it. He's from Pasadena. He self-published it. He said this was number 737,462 in his series, which is obviously
of jokes.
Joke. Yeah, well, the book.
Oh, the book.
I don't know that he ever wrote another one or
all
the
right.
other ones.
Let's leave that behind us and
the
move
other
on.
Ones, the other ones. What do we want to say about Uncabaret, the thing you've been doing? It's 1988.
Well,
I don't know
if that's I don't know if that's true, but it probably is if it's been published.
Are you planning a big anniversary?
We are, because 25th anniversary next year. So it started out with an anniversary show, but then it couldn't be fit into a show. So there's going to be a big show, big celebration show at the end of the year. But leading up to that, we're going to have all sorts of events.
Okay.
And we're planning that now, partnerships and,
right.
you know, and alliances and bringing a lot of old, you know, a lot of the heritage performers back and expand, you know, the whole family. It's a very family, you know, business, so.
Well, that was what I was going to say. I mean, however long it's been.
Yeah.
30 years, 25
25-ish.
Years.
I call it the 25th-ish anniversary.
It's a family.
It is. It's a very family,
show.
Yeah.
And
you know, the beginning.
I love to tell
the Genesis story. I mean, it's because I think it's. You know, I was talking to one of our new performers, a younger performer, last Sunday, and he found it encouraging. So, you know, I think one thing is in creativity, if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen for so many reasons. If anything really comes to be.
Right.
I had a dinner last night with a very successful friend who had a project that was, you know, a whisper away from happening, and it didn't happen for the most insane reason. And, you know, things just fall apart. You know, I don't think people not in the business understand how hard it is to make anything happen, you know.
Because once it happens, it seems like, oh, that was easy. It just popped up.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's not even so, you know, and especially now as the business is so destabilized and uncertain and fractured and as the world is, you know. So the Genesis story, you know, really has three. It's a three-pointed story. Number one, I was always between the performance art world where I really began and the comedy world, which I was just fell in love with comedy and I really wanted to work in the comedy world. And I was working as a comedian. And one night was at the comedy store and I followed Andrew Dice Clay and I was just watching him from backstage and I was like, I hate him and I hate what he's doing and I hate the audience for loving him and laughing. I don't know if they loved him, but they were laughing at him. And I hated myself for hating everything because I'm not even good with hate. You know, and I didn't want to be hating him. I
right.
don't like that feeling.
What's happening?
I'm not that girl who's like gets competitive and then is like, ah, yeah, I'll show them comedy of love. You know, it's all, you know. So that was really, I really knew I had to find another way. And I actually did feel my comedy was getting worse in that environment. I wasn't feeling like, oh, I'm getting up and getting spots and I'm getting better. I felt like, oh, I'm getting up and getting spots and somehow I'm turning into like, you know, something I don't like. And then at the same time, I was also still doing one-person shows and I had gotten very nice reviews for one and now I was taking it to Europe and I did just a small refresher night at a venue downtown, no longer there, called the Women's Building. And it was one of those nights when I want to say they thought it was funnier than it was. Maybe they thought it was as funny as it was, you know. And they were really laughing. It was a big laugh. And it's like it was a dream audience. But I said, you know, you guys, it's not as funny as you think it is. When was the last time you laughed? They said, oh, we don't laugh. We're women and we're artists and we're lesbians. And, you know, if we go to the comedy clubs, they make fun of us.
Exactly.
And
it's
so we don't
them.
Go.
Yeah.
It's not for them. So there was this audience. And so I said to them, after the show, I said, you know what? I'm going to make you a show when I get back from Europe, and it's going to be unhomophobic, unmisogynist, unxenophobic. It will be the Uncabaret. And it was literally born in that instant for that audience. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think is so key to understand. You know, people can become very cynical and be like, oh, the demographic and working towards the, you know, who's your demographic? And that wasn't that. I wasn't thinking about audience as like a demographic. They were people who were left out.
Who are underserved. Who were left out. Yeah.
And then at the same time, the third part of the triangle is the whole comedy community. I mean, you know, leaving Andrew Dice Clay aside, I had a lot of friends who were very funny and very accomplished, not people fighting to get into the business, right, who were frustrated, struggling to find a way to, because at the time what was happening in the comedy world was there was a Seinfeldization.
Is that a verb now?
I'm making it up. Seinfeldization, I think it would have to be. Anyway, where everybody wanted their sitcom, you know, and that was a real thing. They were holding deals and, you know, you would get signed and then they would develop a show for you and maybe you would get on. And, you know, in order to get that, which was a thing to get, yes, now there's almost like nothing. What are you going to get, you know?
But there was a wave of that.
Yeah. There was a big wave of that. And in order to get it, you had to have your 10 minutes. Your tight 10, as it was called.
That was in the early 2000s, late 90s. When did that happen?
No, that was like 88, like when I was in a way back. This is early. This is when it's all coming together.
Got it.
It was these three factors: the comedy community, my own frustration, and the audience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my idea was, so we did it there for a while, and at the Women's Building, they lost their funding. I did a run then at Highways with Taylor Negron and Judy Toll, both sadly passed. We have CDs, or made CDs of each of them on the, or up on iTunes, and both geniuses, really. And then I took a break and ran my campaign to make first lady in elected position. So much to say about that, but let's put a pin in it. And then, and then when Jean Pierre, who is a really artistic club owner, I mean, there's something in
at
Olac. No. Oh. This is at Luna Park back in the day. Yeah. You know, he was opening up the club. This would have been his third club. He was really an artist. He was really a producer artist. You know, a nightclub impresario, and he made spaces that were important. And that's a really big deal. You can't have the work if the space doesn't exist. Right. I mean, the frame makes the picture. So, I mean, you can't have an empty frame. I mean, you know.
You're using the word impresario. That we don't use that very much.
But it's important. It's an important word. And and he had already done Lhasa Club, and he was also the originator of Largo, which a lot of your listeners will have heard of. And, you know, sold that club. And then he opened up this club, Luna Park, which was on Robertson and in the heart of West Hollywood, which is also a very artist-friendly city and had been the Rose Tattoo previously. It's a long history, this building. And it was a beautiful situation because it had a big room upstairs and a smaller room downstairs, and it had a restaurant. And, you know, you would hang out after the show, and it was really community. So, you know, and that room, David Byrne has a really interesting essay, an intro to, there's a history of CBGBs, another very important space. And he, in that space, talks about how the architecture of CBGBs was very important to the music. It was long and narrow and really what that meant to the music and why the music was created for that particular thing. Well, this room downstairs,
you're always jammed in, even if it was only half full.
Yeah.
You always felt
jammed
in.
You always felt, and you also walked in, and then when you walk, you opened a door and you walked down one flight of stairs, so descent into the subconscious.
Yep. Yep.
Then you turned a corner and there's an enormous mirror and you were very small in the mirror. And so you know, number one, got to check out and make sure you looked okay. Number two, it wasn't the kind of mirror where only you existed. You know,
right,
you sort of saw yourself in the world. You know, it's an interesting picture. Yeah. And there's an enormous, beautiful chandelier. And then you turn the corner again and you continue your descent and then you enter the room. So it was really a basement room, you know, in every way that's good.
Yeah,
you know,
I never thought about that being in there. I mean, I hadn't.
Of course not, but it was my life, so I did think about it, you know.
Yeah.
So the architectural significance, I, you know, in college wrote my thesis on, you know, my thesis on the semiotics of architecture. So there you go. It's a topic for me. Yeah, houses and Beth, and you know, it's my name. So you know, there was that. The stage was in a corner. There were so many little things about that room that were so interesting. And then there was also the upstairs where we could expand. We shot our Comedy Central show up there. And there was always great stuff happening. So there was a lot of cross-pollination. Sandra Bernhard was doing shows there. Roseanne was doing shows there. You know, people were doing shows. Yeah.
So after all this, what keeps it fresh for you over all this
Nothing.
Time?
It's Nothing. Not fresh.
It's dead.
I gave it up. I mean, I did give it up. We went from there to HBO Workspace and Knitting Factory. We were there 7 years. Right. I mean, we did our Comedy Central show there. I did a daily radio show. I mean, it was really 7 years. And everybody was there. I mean, if people who are listening, you know, aren't familiar with, you know, really, I think of it as the original group. You know, it's a phenomenal group of comedians who together created a vibration that was higher than any of them. I mean, when you look at the history of creativity, everything important happened with groups, because a group, you know, you look at, you know, in painting, the Surrealists, the Dadaists, you know, all the movements, the Abstract Expressionists, you know, you look at the literary movements, you look at the Left Bank, you look at Gertrude Stein, you know, you look at all of it. And, you know, think about this combination of people. Bob Odenkirk, Patton Oswalt, Kathy Griffin, Janine Garofalo, Andy Kindler, Andy Dix, Scott Thompson, Taylor Negron, Judy Toll, Julia Sweeney, Margaret Cho, Karen Kilgariff, and that's, you know, just off the top of my head, and Jeff Garlin.
In the same time period.
This is every Sunday. Every Sunday it's a group of the, you know, and then, yeah, you know, and others coming and going. But,
sure. But that was the main.
But that's a, you know, I know I'm forgetting. Oh, David Cross, big part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Meryl Marco, important. You know, a lot of.
I like Meryl Marco.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah, she's great. She was just with us at the Lenny Bruce event. So
can I ask a question about that, the Lenny Bruce thing? Or do you got something to...
Well, let me answer what keeps it fresh, because, yeah, you know, I did put it away to do other stuff. Uh-huh. And honestly, this room became available. And again, with the room, you know, and Mitch Kaplan and I were working on some other stuff and hanging out, and this friend of ours said, hey, there's this room, my friend, the thing, and... Yeah, they're looking for stuff. And I was, you know, we were both like, oh, sure, yeah, room. I mean, what great room in L.A. haven't you? I mean, it's just like, to keep a great room going, you know, is so hard. And how can there be a great room we don't know about? All right, sure, we'll drive down. So we drive down and meet them. And you open the door and it's like, oh, my God. What? How is this room here? How is this room a secret? I mean, how do we not know about this room? This is an incredible room. It's what? And so I start thinking of all these other things we can do, and, you know, this, the playtime with Beth and Mitch, and this, and then Mitch was really, I mean, he's the hero of the new version, because he was really like, no, let's do Uncabaret, and I was like, Uncabaret's dead to me, I'm done with that show. I gave a lot of my years, sure, to that show. And he said, let's just do one for your birthday, it'll be fun, we'll do it together. I thought, we'll do one for, and then it was, you know, it's 5.5 years later. So what keeps it fresh for me is, you know, in a way, the same thing I've always loved about it, which is that it's different every Sunday. And that the joy of finding new performers, you know, there's a new group of performers who I'm in love with and who are really, I mean, how do you make friends? You know, people that you love their work if you're an artist. So it's a great way. And it's not being done. You know, I really went around at that point. I said, you know, I don't know, because I really don't know. I mean, I think we did our work, and there's a whole all-comedy movement, and it happened, and the work is done. You know, it just seems maybe besides the point. So
the,
I went...
The
I
family
went,
part seemed... The family,
family part is interesting, but I went around, and I started looking at shows, and I was like, no. It's missing. It's not being done. What this show is not being done. So... So we started, and, you know, it just, and then we got the Amazon episodes, and that sort of gave it some, you know, an early piece of juice, and those are some things that keep going. My own curiosity and obsessiveness, I would think.
That also keeps it going. Well, you mentioned The Lenny Bruce event. Mm-hmm. You guys did at the Taper, right?
We did at the Los Angeles Public Library's Mark Taper Auditorium.
I understand.
Yes, I don't want to just say the Taper the Taper call and say, who's this girl?
All right, no, I got that wrong. But the question is, you said that from doing that event, you learned some new things about him.
I did.
Now, because he's obviously...
I learned he's alive. No. number one, he was a storyteller.
Yeah.
And... he's a lot cuter than Dustin Hoffman, which you forget if you've only ever seen the movie. And you forget how much that's part of show business. You know, the look. He's adorable. And, he's just another bad boy. His love of language is incredible. And, how much he opened doors. Comedy, as we saw with this joke, top of show, it doesn't necessarily cross the time boundaries that well. So I have listened to stuff and gone, But nevertheless, his legacy and what he did... I just had my respect for it sort of grew,
He really exposed himself in a way that, maybe other people were at that time, but I don't think so.
No, other people were getting arrested for the bad words, and that's what people don't know, is he wasn't the first one to get arrested.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Many people were being arrested, but he was the one who grabbed onto it as a cause célèbre, made it a big deal. Really his first arrest, when it comes right down to it, and Bob Whitey has Bob Whitey has an amazing documentary.
Can we say Whitey will pay? No, Whitey will pay. Whitey.
Yeah.
Whitey will pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And in it, I watched it, and I thought, so this is really the story. He was in, I always conflate it, whether it's Philadelphia or Baltimore. And he went to a party, which is something you do as a performer, to promote, to fluff the city, to fluff the alumni, to whoever, you have to go. You're doing your other part of your work. And he said something that it got somebody mad. And it was really the stuff that was really getting him in trouble was... the stuff against religion and the hypocrisy of religion.
Right.
And I don't know what he said at the party, but because he said what he said at the party, and he pissed on the floor. That I think is not necessarily known. He really got there was a thing, and he peed, and the cops came to his hotel the next day and busted him for drugs, and he had a script for them, and they were legal, but he was busted anyway, and then he was offered a deal. And just pay this thing and we'll, pay the people off. And he named the people who offered him a deal. And so really, though it's the work that he really went down for, it's the behavior around the work. But I also really got the sense, so really it's really his behavior at a party, that really ultimately made everyone so mad. But what I really got the sense of is he just really did... it's almost like sometimes a role has to be filled. I mean, there's something about martyrdom, like somebody's got to do it. Right, like somebody had to do it, and he really did do it, and he was really the person who did it. He was very prolific. He would often – Paul Krasner, if you guys are interested, is a great source on this. And he did new material a lot. He was very uncab. I mean, Meryl Marco was like, God, he was so uncab. He would have just been perfect at uncab because he was doing new material all the time. And this sort of broke my heart, and I loved also, where his work really started to take off. When he started to do work, he was just doing this, very typical nothing impressions. Although even then, he did an impression of – he was doing like – movie stars of the day, but he was doing them he had just come back from the army, and so he was doing them as a German doing them. So even then, he's like, what kind of twist, what can I find to make it interesting, But when his work really started to evolve and take off, it's because he was working in strip clubs, and it wasn't precious. And there is something about that freedom, when you have the freedom as an artist to not be precious, and you really just... doing it from a very natural place. And that's one thing that keeps Sundays fresh for me. It's a very natural, organic place to be, And so those are some things I learned about Lenny Bruce.
Part of what surprised me when I started to really watch his things or listen to him, his recordings, you know, the reputation is he was rebellious and angry.
Yeah.
And he is having a lot of fun.
He's
up
so,
there.
Yeah, exactly. He's it goes with the cuteness. He's adorable and he's giggling and he's really, cracking himself yeah. up and, yeah. you know, cracking himself up. He's just really yeah. doing it. But so serious, too. Yeah. No.
But he was having fun yeah. doing it. He wasn't always, you know, the angry guy reading his court transcripts.
No, that came at the end.
That came towards the end.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be funny if you started out that way? Here's some imaginary court transcripts from a future that might unfold.
That might unfold.
And then it did unfold. Oh, my God.
All right. So here, this is a kind of serious question.
Oh. Hasn't it all been serious so far?
I'm not sure. Yeah, well, except for the beginning.
And also, I love to laugh. That's one reason I keep doing it.
No, I know you love to laugh. As I read things that you write,
yeah.
you know, you write, you're a writer.
I'm a writer. I write a lot of stuff.
I've only known you a year.
Yeah.
And there's really a strong current in that everything for you comes to love. And it comes back to love.
Yeah.
And you're promoting love. And I don't know whether that has always been true or it's true just in the past year that I've known you or...
Mm.
Yeah, that's one part of the question. Mm-hmm. I have a part B.
Okay.
Is this new or old for you? This focus on...
Love?
Returning things to love.
Yeah. Well, maybe newer. Maybe always, but maybe new also. Okay. I mean, everything that you are, it's all... I really do feel like... I guess, I don't know if I've ever said it this way, but I do feel like, in a sense, we do come from seeds. And we grow, and everything that's possible is possible at the beginning.
Right.
It's all there, everything you're going to be. But I also don't feel it's all faded and written in stone either. I feel there's a lot of malleability and... You know, if you've, it's like a plant, you know, you're going to water it, put it in sun, take care of it, feed it. It's going to look one way and you're right. going to put it, you know, blah, you know.
Under the bed.
Or the other thing.
The other thing.
Yeah. Or the bad thing. So I think a couple of things, you know, just growing up and asking yourself what's important. And that's, you know, a softening. I think that... You know, I crossed a passage myself of just some hard times and the usual grown-up things. And you know, you come out of that, you're either harder or softer. You have two choices.
Right.
You know, you
yeah.
either yeah. harden and sort of ossify or you soften and bloom. And I did make a decision to change my life. And one of those things is to bring things back to love. And because it's just such a much more beautiful way to live. And I feel it's needed. I mean, I just feel this real pull. I feel like we did enter, you know, I went and I lived in the desert for a little while and I really looked at a lot of big things. And that's what I did on my, you know,
yeah.
on my summer vacation for Mont Cabaret.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I really do believe we are entering a different age and a different time and there's a consciousness shift. I believe all that stuff.
I hope so. I hope that.
But it could, there's a shadow part of it and a light part of it. And
right.
It needs everyone. You can't say I believe that and then live your life unaccordingly.
Well, that needs watering and sunlight and food just as much
yeah.
as we do.
So that means, like, looking at love, that means really booking people I love. That means, you know... Not being cynical, that means the hardest task, trying to love yourself. I mean, for me, you know, from probably every artist, you know, because without looking at the difficult things, you're... So all of that, and even though I sort of stopped, I mean, I did get obsessed with, like, you know, the UFOs and the this and the that and the, you know, the angels and the orbs. And, you know, at a certain point I was like, instead of trying to understand the invisible world, maybe you should try to understand the visible world. Why don't you try to understand what you can see? And even though I now feel this presence of everythingness,
yes.
Auras and chakras, and I mean, I believe that...
You're talking about angels in the past.
Yeah,
we've
all
had
of it. Yeah, we've had it.
Yeah,
it's all comes up, but, you know, the thing that's real, that you can feel that is invisible, that's in everybody's life, is love.
Is love. Yeah. So the second part of the question is, how do we hold on to this when the other people are assholes or crazy or just different? The world, arguably, at the moment, is kind of a terrifying place.
Well, number one, we accept that we are also assholes.
You know, I say people are assholes, and sometimes it's me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, and we're difficult. And we're hypocritical.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we are everything. Yeah. But, you know, I think there are people on quote-unquote both sides who are good people.
Absolutely.
Then there are other people who are not good people, and I don't look at them on I feel like it's about their, you know, looking for similarities. That's one thing to do. And it's also about drawing lines and boundaries and just saying, you know, this is not okay with me, but not wasting your energy. I mean, it's really tricky. I mean, I don't want to make it seem
it's
like, oh, sure, just do this. Yeah. I mean, every single day it's about, you know, being proactive, creating a life that you feel you can believe in. And that's not that easy.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to go back to the answer to what you said in the beginning. We hit these places and we have a choice whether to harden up or soften. And that's just for you. You know what I mean? That's not about the world. It's just for us inside. And in my heart, do I want to keep getting softer or keep getting harder? And
then, yeah, I mean, I know. I mean,
regardless of what's
happening. And it's just, you know, it's like the one of the metaphors is the onion. You just keep getting to new layers of the onion.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that was hard for me is, you know, there was a time when I was younger than I comedy can come from a very know-it-all point of view. I mean, it's funny to know everything. I mean, and then at a certain point, you know, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I don't know anything. And I don't know anything. And that's going to really change my whole take on everything, is that I'm just really open to not knowing.
Mm.
But you do know, I mean, but in some senses, knowing that, you do know more.
You know something.
But, you know, I'm really looking at defensiveness, right? Like, it just keeps going. Like, for me, I'm looking a lot at my own defensiveness right now. I can get very defensive.
Yep.
Well, look, I'm a woman. There's a lot to defend against right there. I'm Jewish. Defensive. I was in the hospital when I was 5, genesis of becoming an artist. So many stories about that. Life-threatening. La, la, la. A lot of needles. Spinal taps. La, 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 la. You know, and I defended myself. And, you know, there comes a point where you start to realize, like, okay, you know, when people say to you, if say you're working on defensiveness, you know, you're being defensive. And you're, no, I'm not. You know, and there's no way to even ever start.
Right.
And then at a certain point, I was like, you know, but not in the moment, I just had to, like, you know, I think this might be true. And I started to look at it not, you know, in an incident.
Right.
And that's a lot of it, too, not looking at it in an incident. So, you know, I started to look at that and I started to see, like, wow, I could be moving through the world more openly. And, you know, then you go, well, is the enemy, you know, moving through them? Well, no. But
who cares about
that? You just do it. You just keep evolving and growing.
Yeah, I don't care
and,
about
you know,
that.
Build in, you know, collecting tools, you know, and comedy is certainly a tool and it's a thing that you use tools in and you are a tool, but I don't know. You know, meditation. I've always meditated, but a couple of years I started a more rigorous meditation practice that I believe in now. You know, I don't. In 4 years, I could decide it's a cult. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Well, we're going to check back with you in 4 years to see if you've been sucked into this thing or not. All right, now we're going to do something that is not serious. I swear to God.
That's all right. I love to be serious.
I have this question. Well, okay, I have a question every week that is sponsored. And this week...
A sponsored question?
This week, this question, it's about pie. The question is sponsored by the Velveteria, which is a museum in Chinatown where the people are totally passionate about the outsider art of velvet painting.
Oh, I love velvet painting. I've painted on velvet.
Yeah, and I heard they have a Ryan Seacrest unicorn painting on velvet. So we're just going to go and check it out there. So if you want to see the Ryan Seacrest as a unicorn on velvet, you should go to Velveteria. It's at 711 New High Street in Chinatown. So here's the question.
I don't know if I'll be able to think of anything else besides Ryan Seacrest as a unicorn on Velvet, but go ahead.
Black Velvet, yeah. He's not black. So a number of years ago, I was wondering how I could make the world a better place, a happier place, make people happy. And I got this message from an unknown source saying, you could tell friends and family that it's okay to hit you in the face with a pie anytime and without warning. So I did it, and over the past 20 years, I've been hit in the face with a pie a lot of times, and it makes them happy. Because you never have permission to hit somebody, but I've given them permission that makes it okay. So the question for you is, if you were going to do this, give permission to one person to hit you in the face with a pie. It could be anyone, living or dead throughout history, somebody that you would like to meet. Who would you like to have throw the pie?
Oh, somebody I'd like to meet?
Well, somebody that, one person in the world that you would like to, or through any time.
I feel like I always fail this question.
Well, it
somebody I would
matter.
Like to meet.
Somebody, somebody you would like to have throw a pie in your face, and then you have a moment with that person.
Jeez.
Don't think too hard.
Gertrude Stein, Marilyn Monroe, Gloria Steinem.
Feminist icons.
Ladies I love.
Yeah. Gertrude Stein. What would that... I'm curious how that would
be. A pie is a pie.
Bang.
Or maybe Joaquin Phoenix. But he... I don't know. Sure. All those people. You. Anybody. Who... Is it a delicious pie? Will I get to eat it? That's all I want to know.
It's going to hit you in the face. I guess you could make some choices of what kind of pie you would like.
Conan O'Brien. He'd be fun. He's so tall.
You're just enjoying being hit in the face with the pie.
I love it. Is it a banana cream pie? Because that would
be
the that's I think more important decision. What kind of pie?
What kind of pie?
Yeah, because if it's an apple pie, no one. But if it's a blueberry pie, please not. But a banana cream pie, Charlie Chaplin.
What's the difference? Why no blueberry?
Mae West. Mae West. Love to have Mae West hit me with pie.
That's actually
that would just be amazing.
I mean, Gloria Steinem would be. I mean, not Gloria.
Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein, you said first. That would be good.
That would be good. Yeah.
Mae West would be good, too.
Make it, yeah. All good.
Wow. See, there's no wrong answers for this.
No, that's reassuring. But a blueberry pie, you know, a lot of staining.
Yeah.
A lot of staining and a lot of cleaning up.
Banana cream pie. You could just have
it. It's very light and frothy.
Just a whipped cream pie shaving cream pie.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Wow. What about Ryan Seacrest as a unicorn?
I'd love to have a unicorn throw me a pie at me. Yeah.
All right. Oh, I like Gertrude Stein.
All right.
Maybe I'll pick that in the future.
I sat next to a girl on an airplane a couple of weeks ago, and she was like a crazy girl. She was maybe in her 20s, mm-hmm. and she had a strange hat, and she had just too many bracelets. I've been that girl. Too many bracelets. And everything was a little awry and maybe a little bit of a hippie and maybe skin not perfect. You know, she was struggling.
Working it out.
And she was working it out. And she had on her forearm a giant tattoo of Marilyn Monroe. Mm. I've been thinking about Marilyn Monroe since then. And I just thought, that's so much pressure. No wonder you're freaking out. I mean, why are you going to get Marilyn Monroe tattooed on you? I mean, you'll never live up to that tattoo.
Did you ask her?
No. First rule of an airplane flight, don't talk to anybody.
Never ask a question about anything. All right. We got a little bit of time left.
We don't have to. We can call it a day.
We could call it a day. I did have one more specific question.
All right.
Because earlier this year you said that you all of a sudden changed your tune, and now you love the 4th of July. You know that? And again, what happened? Did something happen?
I think it's all part of my softening.
Yeah.
You know, why go around hating it? I mean, it seemed very like bombs and explosions and, you know, we're celebrating war. But looked at from another point of view, it's colors in the sky and a reason to be with family and celebration of freedom and the good part of independence, which is really interdependence and all that. And I just, you know, looking through the eyes of somebody who loved 4th of July and being with people. I don't know. When it's possible to love something now, I try to, rather than not loving it as a choice.
Yeah. No, I think that's if you look for ways to.
When you look for ways to love things, there is a more of a chance that you will find a way.
Right.
You know, and yes, war is not good. It isn't great. You know, but we're in this really strange phase where it's like, I remember, so this is a mini story. So I was working as an actress on a little independent movie, and we were on, I was playing an agent or an executive. Anyway, that's all I ever play is offbeat authority figures. If you're casting or a producer, director, and you need an offbeat authority figure, I am your girl. Gallery owners, studio heads, gurus, all of it.
And
anyway.
So do they usually trigger the main characters to go through some...
They're just bossy and yeah. But offbeat,
I understand.
But not like a corporate boss.
Got it.
So anyway, the girl who was the artist, who was British or Australian or something, was we had to bring our own wardrobe. It was that kind of thing. And of course, I brought 1,000 different choices, and she hadn't brought anything. And she wanted to borrow a jacket. And I'm not a good clothes sharer, or at least I wasn't then. And I didn't want to.
Because people walk off with stuff.
But I let her finally. And then, so that's one thing. And then we break for lunch. And it's a soft script, you know, soft scripted. And so we're improvising a lot. And we break for lunch. And she says to me, remember, we're eating pizza and I'm in the lotus position, if that gives you a picture. Right. And we're at the William Morris office. They were my agents at the time, so it was very layered. Anyway, so she says to me, we're talking about world peace, and she says, oh, world peace would be such a bore. And I just got so freaking mad. I was furious. And then there's an addendum, which is I wrapped, and she didn't wrap, and she had to give me back she drove my jacket to my house, and it just really, I had to have it cleaned, and I thought that was so wrong, you know, that... Anyway, it was returned to me. But it, you know, and then I used to tell the story like that was the point. Like, oh, and then she,
gave
me back the stinky jacket. And that's the kind of person who doesn't believe in peace, is this person. And every now and then I would revisit the story. And then suddenly this year, it occurred to me like, well, would world peace be a bore? I mean, what is my picture of world peace? I mean, maybe I keep telling the story because she's right. I mean, maybe I don't have a picture of world peace that I can put us out and go, it's not a bore, honey, because, like, this is what it would look like. And,
we've never had it.
I wasn't able to say, like, let me sell you world peace. I mean, I wasn't able to say to her, no, here's what world peace is. It's me feeling happy about giving you my jacket. That's what world peace is. I don't care. Have my jacket. Have the one I'm wearing. I don't even need a jacket. Let's do it in the nude. I mean, that's what world peace is me not being troubled by the fact that I don't like your attitude about borrowing my clothes, or the fact she goes, oh, you really love the sound of your own voice, don't you? And it's like, well, I'm improvising. That's my character. Yeah. But then I, instead of getting defensive about it.
That would have made me defensive. You really love the sound of your own voice. Yeah, no, that would have done
it. I mean, it's funny in a way. I mean, I'm an actor. I'm playing a bossy character. Yeah. Of course I'm talking a lot. And I don't like listening. I'm a comedian. So there you go. But it's this is when you talk about change and shift, and you didn't used to like I don't know why that story just came to my mind, but it, because we're talking about war and peace and what it means and how to change, it's this thing of being able to be peaceful in yourself and love yourself. And, you know, it sounds so stupid. You know, it just sounds so stupid to talk about. It just sounds ridiculous, but that's the task.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
No, we've never had world peace. We've never had in the history of the world.
Well, I mean, it's nothing is static. Here's the thing. There isn't a thing as... I mean, here's why. Because peace is... We think of it as a stable thing. World peace, and it's flatlining. You know, flatlining, fine. When you say things are fine, that's a contraction for flatline.
Yes.
And it's like being dead. You know, we're not talking about fineness. We're talking about... you know, love and joy and being able to take in the sorrows and roll with them and convert pain. I mean, this is why I love comedy. Maybe just close on this. You know, it's the oldest adage about comedy, you know, pain plus time equals comedy. So, you know, peace is really that. Peace is the gift of time. Time, I mean, you know, time is what is our is one of our biggest challenges. We don't have enough time. The clock is ticking. And time isn't real and time isn't linear. This is just, no one can show that time exists. Time is one of the greatest mysteries. So, you know, peace is really part of time. It's the part, to me, this is, you know, the equation that we haven't quite gotten. There's a part of time that has to do with peace, that if we start to understand peace, time will become clear and we'll understand the medium in which we live, which is sort of time that we can't see. Something right. like that.
All right, well, I'm going to say
the
time.
Absence of yes over time equals no. I know that.
Well, and the other way is to say it is that which does not kill us makes us funnier.
Something like that.
Well, I would like to thank my guest, the entertaining and nurturing Beth Lapidus, for coming in this week. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, I just sold 5 of them.
Wow.
My first 5. You can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. Just for the record, I've never received any emails at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv.
That's because you're on social media.
I should probably check and see if it even works.
Can I say my social media?
Yes,
everybody should come find me.
Yeah. How do we find Beth? Go do it.
You can find me, of course, at uncabaret.com, UNCABARET. On various social media, I'm at Beth Lapidus. On Instagram, I'm Beth_Lapidus. I'm also at Uncabaret. Some other people sometimes take care of those accounts, but usually it's me. And Sundays, Sunday nights is
every
the
Sunday.
Night for Uncabaret. Come down and, as I like to say, come for the comedy, stay for the hug.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful room down there.
Beautiful room with delicious vegan
and
food.
Great vegan food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are we here in the extra? Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Marmel. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks.